I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Dr. Robert Langer, founder of the Langer Labs at MIT, one of the world's largest biomedical engineering labs with $10 million in annual grants and 100 researchers. He's pioneered the fields of tissue engineering and drug delivery, which has led to the development of over 30 companies. He is a father of three children and a magician. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Your influence on the biomaterials field is vast, and I'd like to start with the early days of your professional life because, in a way, it helped to inform what you are doing today. After graduating from Cornell, you were a graduate student at MIT, and this was during the 1970s, during the energy crisis. How did the energy crisis indirectly lead you to the field of scientific discovery?
Sure. There was this gas shortage, you know, all over the country, and the gas shortage in Boston was really bad. So there were all kinds of jobs in the petrochemical oil industry for chemical engineers. They were hiring like crazy. Pretty much my colleagues, my friends, that's what they did. They got jobs in the oil industry, and so I thought that's what I should do too. So I went to a lot of interviews, and I got about 20 job offers from different oil companies, actually four from Exxon alone. But I remember one of them in particular, one of the engineers said to me, you know, if you could just increase the yield of this one chemical by like 0.1%, he said, that would be wonderful. It'd be worth billions of dollars. And I remember flying home to Boston that night thinking to myself, I just don't want to do that. It just seemed to me, you know, that I could, there were things that I could do with my life that I thought maybe could help people and would be more important, at least to me. So I started looking for other ideas about what I could do.
Now, you sent some ideas for a chemistry curriculum to various education institutions. How were they received?
One of the things I did when I was a graduate student at MIT is I helped start a school for poor kids and high school, and I got involved in creating new chemistry curricula. And so I remember writing letters, answering different ads to different colleges to be an assistant professor that would be developing new chemistry curriculum. But none of them wrote me back. So the next thing I thought about, since I wasn't doing so well finding good jobs or finding any jobs where I could do chemistry education, I thought about medicine. So I wrote a lot of hospitals and medical schools, and they didn't write me back either. But one day, one of the people in the lab where I was at said to me, Bob, there's this surgeon in Boston named Judah Folkman. And he said, sometimes he hires unusual people. He thought very highly of Dr. Folkman. I won't say what he thought about me. But I wrote to Dr. Folkman, and he was kind enough to offer me a job.
And it was your research with Dr. Folkman that had a seminal impact on what you're doing today to some degree. What was it specifically that you were working on?
So Dr. Folkman had a theory that if you could stop blood vessels from growing in the body, that might be a new way to stop cancer someday, a new way to treat cancer someday. But it was a theory, and actually a lot of people didn't agree with that theory. And what he asked me to do was to see if I could isolate what would become the first inhibitor of angiogenesis, the first inhibitor of blood vessel growth. So that's how I got started.
If you could stop the growth of blood vessels, you could stop the growth of tumors developing further. Is that correct?
Yeah. The thinking was is that tumors without blood vessels will not go beyond a very tiny size of about 1 mm³. But if the tumor is permeated by blood vessels, then that solves the nutrition problem for them, and they can get much bigger. And then, of course, they can also metastasize or spread through those same blood vessels and set up shop in other parts of the body.
You used an eye of a rabbit to help with your research. What is special about the eye of a rabbit?
Yeah, well, it's big, so it's easy to visualize. So what we thought about was if we could have a plastic, a slow-release polymer, that could take anything that was in cartilage, that's what we were studying, and A, not cause harm to the eye, and B, deliver those molecules for a couple months or more, that might be a way to study how blood vessels would grow or not grow.
You mentioned polymers. These are plastics, essentially.
The polymers we use would be plastics. Polymers could also be rubber and so forth. Polymer is basically a long chain substance.
We're talking about manufactured tissues, polymers. What was the landscape of biomaterials when you were pioneering this field in the 1970s?
Yeah, well, it's interesting. Most biomaterials that people used in the body were largely driven by medical doctors, clinicians. And what they do is they would often go to their house and find an object that would kind of resemble the organ or tissue they wanted to fix. So just to give a few examples, the material in the artificial heart, that was a lady's girdle material because it had a good, you know, good buoyancy or flex life. And the material in a breast implant, that was actually, one of them was actually a mattress stuffing because it was the right squishiness. The material in a what's called a vascular graft, an artificial blood vessel, that was a surgeon going to a clothes store and finding something they could sew well with. And so almost all of the biomaterials in the 70s had origins like that. They were sort of what I'd call off-the-shelf materials. And that may solve some problems, but it also created problems because they weren't optimally designed for the body. For example, if you take the artificial heart, the lady's girdle material, you put it in the body and sometimes the blood hits the surface of that and it forms a clot. Mm. And that clot could go to the patient's brain and they'd get a stroke and they die. And obviously, there's been problems with different breast implant materials and other things as well.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is the chemical engineer, Dr. Robert Langer, who is the chief researcher and founder of the Langer Labs at MIT. He's considered a pioneer in the fields of tissue engineering and drug delivery. In the 1980s, you founded the Langer Lab at MIT. What was the purpose for this lab?
My goals were to do things that I thought might someday help and improve people's lives by doing things at the interface of chemical engineering and medicine.
How was it received when you went to the administration at MIT and said, you know, I'd like to form this lab just to facilitate this research that I'm doing?
Yeah, well, certainly my early years of doing the research, you know, a number of my senior colleagues didn't think it was very important or didn't think it was very good, and they suggested that I probably should start looking for new jobs.
Why was it? Because your field was so nascent, there weren't a lot of... Why was that?
I think that people's idea of what's important probably has a lot to do with what they're doing themselves. And, you know, and they had different areas in this department, but this didn't fit into any of those. And I think the thinking was if I didn't fit into something that pre-existed, I probably wouldn't get promoted. I probably wouldn't get tenure.
Since your research wasn't well received at MIT, did you ever think of maybe moving to an environment that was more friendly to the type of work you were doing?
Well, I actually think MIT was as friendly as any place. You know, my first 9 grants were turned down, and nobody at MIT were on the sections that turned them down. In fact, MIT was you know, I still think is a great place to be. If you go against the prevailing scientific wisdom anywhere in the world, you're going to run into problems.
So how did you break through that conventional bias?
Well, I don't know if I really ever did. I just kept doing the work that I thought was important, and I started, you know, publishing it. And I think pharmaceutical companies started to notice it. And they said that they were nice enough to say that the work they thought was very important.
What were some examples of early breakthroughs that helped to lend credibility to what you were doing?
So we had published this paper in 1976 in Nature showing that you could deliver molecules of almost any size. So that was probably the breakthrough, or that was maybe the first breakthrough. But people thought trying to get these molecules, big molecules, through a plastic was kind of like you or I walking through a brick wall.
Even though the plastic was porous?
Well, people didn't know that then, and we didn't know that then either. So the challenge would be the following. You could either have something that would be non-porous that you couldn't get through at all, or anything that was porous would be kind of like Swiss cheese, so you could get through it, but then you'd get through it almost instantaneously. Mm. And what we were seeing was that we'd have these tiny little particles, and yet the drugs would come out for over 100 days. So the problem would be, how could that happen? And that just defied what I like to say, conventional wisdom.
We talk about your research gaining academic acceptance. What was the first example of the commercialization of one of your findings?
Well, there were a couple, but I think one of the early ones was we designed polymers that could dissolve in a certain special way, and what we call surface erosion, kind of like how bar soap dissolves. And what was done in this particular case is it delivers an anti-cancer drug. It's all done locally, so the cancer drug doesn't go throughout the whole body. It just is given locally to the tumor. And then there was a company originally Nova Pharmaceuticals and later Guilford Pharmaceuticals that licensed it and developed it, and ultimately it led to a product that's still used today, actually, in treating brain cancer called the Gliadel wafer.
This is one of the earliest examples of the commercialization of one of your discoveries. Since then, roughly 250 companies have licensed or sublicensed your discoveries. Were you surprised by this torrent of commercial applications for what you were doing?
Yeah, it's hard to say whether I was surprised or not. I wanted people to use it. You know, when you're in academia and you're a professor, I mean, you're training students, which I love to do, and you're making discoveries and findings, which is also what I like to do. But I also want to see what we do get used. I just don't want it to be a scientific paper that just, you know, people read about. I wanted to see what we did have an impact on people's lives. That's why I got involved in the patenting process, and that's why, you know, I wanted to see our things get licensed to companies and ultimately license, you know, create companies ourselves, because if we didn't do that, you know, I find if you're not your own champion, it's very hard to find others who are going to be.
Often there's controversy around tech transfer of universities or academics using their discoveries for commercial ends because it leads to potential conflicts of interest. What was that landscape like for you?
I think MIT, you know, along with Stanford, is probably the top two technology transfer places in the world. And I think their goal is really the same as mine. It's not actually to make money. It's really how can we, you know, maximize the chances of products being developed.
MIT, which was founded in 1861, one of its missions was to provide and support industrialization of America. So MIT had more of a commercial slant to it than perhaps other academic institutions.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think MIT wants to see products created. They want to see things get out to the public.
Incidentally, once a technology or an innovation is discovered and is profitable, it's split in three ways. A third of the profit goes to the department, a third goes to the university, and a third goes to the inventor.
As far as I know, that's the policy that MIT uses, and I think a lot of universities follow something close to that.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Robert Langer, a pioneer in the fields of tissue engineering and drug delivery. We'll hear more from Dr. Langer coming up. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Dr. Robert Langer, founder of the Langer Labs at MIT, one of the world's largest biomedical engineering labs, with $10 million in annual grants and 100 researchers. Dr. Langer has helped to launch close to 30 companies, and he holds over 800 issued or pending patents. 250 companies have licensed or sublicensed his lab's discoveries. We're talking about the profitability of some of these discoveries, and you turn to the private sector for the funding of some of these companies. Polaris is a venture capital company in Boston that has invested over $200 million in your companies, roughly 20 companies. How did that relationship start?
There was a company that I was starting with a woman named Sherry Oberg, and she was wanted to have a company that would create the new imaging agents, and we'd published a paper actually in Science that lended itself to doing that. She was a Dartmouth graduate in the business school. She knew a guy named Terry McGuire, and she introduced me to him, and it was probably early 90s, and she also asked if he was interested in investing in the company, which he did. So we've had a great relationship. I mean, like you said, they've probably done close to 20 companies that we've been involved in.
What are imaging agents? You said that you developed imaging.
Yeah, so in this case, let's say you were doing an ultrasound, and for certain things, you can use ultrasound and, you know, get a pretty good picture. But for example, if you wanted to see whether you had a heart defect or certain other kinds of vascular abnormality, and you tried to use ultrasound, the contrast isn't good enough. So if you could create an ultrasound contrast agent that was good enough, then you could see things by ultrasound imaging that you wouldn't really be able to see otherwise. And you could certainly see it with much, much greater detail.
So, for instance, if you're pregnant and you go to get an ultrasound, are some of these imaging agents used in seeing the baby in the placenta?
So, in the case of looking at a baby, you don't need to do that because I think the contrast's good enough. But if you wanted to look at if you wanted to look at something much smaller, let's say you wanted to look at I'll make this up, the baby's toe or something like that, and you wanted to zoom in on it, might be very hard to see with a regular picture. The contrast agent might be useful for doing that. Mm-hmm. By the way, I think there are still hardly any ultrasound agents approved, the ultrasound contrast agents approved. I expect there will be by this or others, but it's a long road to getting approval for anything.
You mentioned that these have not been approved yet, and a firm like Polaris has been very patient. It's patient capital, understanding that they might not see proceeds for decades.
That's right. I mean, though they've done very well, as far as I know, from what I guess people in business called an IRR standpoint. I mean, I think people in the investment business understand that when you're doing medical work, you don't do it on the sales at the time, you do it on the promise of the company. And that's turned out to work. I mean, an early company that I was an advisor to for many, many years was Genentech. And that came out in the stock market and did fantastic. And they had no products, a lot of promise. But ultimately, they did get products, and those products were blockbusters.
Let's talk about the entrepreneurial nature of what you've done. Sure. You're a pioneer in science. You are also a pioneer in tech transfer, in a way, in commercializing a lot of this research. What are some of the hurdles that you've faced entrepreneurially, even outside of, you know, the development of your lab in the early days in the 1980s?
Yeah, well, I think the challenges that you run into when you try to do entrepreneurial things, I mean, one is always raising money, but two is, again, some of your colleagues won't think highly of it. You know, Dr. Folkman actually said it very well once. He actually got one of the earliest industrial grants. He got about $23 million from Monsanto for his cancer research in the 1970s. And he was at a dinner and somebody asked him, what are the advantages and disadvantages of getting that kind of money? And he said, well, let me do the disadvantages first. He said, there's a gene that a lot of people have that's not expressed directly, it's expressed indirectly. And he said that gene is called jealousy. And if you're a young faculty member, that's not such a good thing because people can control your future. You know, and then a third thing is anytime you try to create any entity, you're dealing with all kinds of people. I mean, with different personalities. I mean, that's good because they're going to, but somehow they have to come together to create this company. And you have to have good business people and good scientists and good clinical people. And sometimes there might be conflicts. And so you have to try to help on those things.
You've helped to launch close to 30 companies. It's not like you're being Jeff Bezos and you launched one company called Amazon. Here you have sprinkled dozens of companies around in your atmosphere. So how do you think about starting a company? Do you just say, well, here's a great idea, and hey, you CEO with this specific background, you go run with it, and I'll advise? You're like a godfather to these companies more than in the trenches every day.
Yeah, well, I think that's probably fair. I mean, to me, my major mission still is being a professor and teaching and doing research at MIT and training students. But I also want, when we create something, for it to get out to the public. And my students and postdocs, some of them will go into academic positions, some of them want to take their inventions and make a company out of it. And so so if we're fortunate enough to A, have made an important discovery, and B, have somebody who wants to run with it, you know, I want to help them do that.
Incidentally, some of the applications for your research have been in fields other than medicine. One example is in the waste industry. Can you describe that?
Well, actually, one of the things that one of our postdocs, Avi Dohm, created was a polymer, but that would help in what's called flocculation.
And what
that means is, if like you have a swimming pool and you have waste or junk in the swimming pool, you know, it could be leaves or it could be, you know, dirt, anything, a flocculant is something that makes those things come together. So rather than it be over your entire pool, over your entire surface, it comes together and it's very easy to then remove. And so there's something that company licensed called Superflock that's very, very widely used.
What are some other tangible technologies that have come out of your lab that we might know of?
Well, we've created fat substitutes that people have used for foods.
What's an example? Like what product?
Like for example, Hood no-fat sour cream or yogurts. Those use these products. Hmm. I mean, there are a whole bunch of things like that. There's a company we've started called Living Proof, which is in the hair care industry. And also Jennifer Aniston is involved in that as well.
As an investor.
Yes. And so there's products that the company and my students and postdocs and everybody we've and people at the company have created that can prevent frizzy hair, that can give hair more body. And of course, all the medical ones, some of the companies that we've been involved in, I mean, they've created products that can help people with schizophrenia, help people with alcoholism, help people with diabetes.
What's an example of an application of your discovery to treatment of alcoholism?
So the very first company that I got involved starting was a company called Enzatec. And what we did was make this came out from our early discoveries that we could make microspheres that could release molecules of any size. We merged that company with our downstairs neighbor, Alchemies. And basically that company has created a microsphere that can deliver a drug for a month. It's been shown to greatly reduce alcoholism.
So a microsphere being a polymer that releases a chemical that inhibits the desire to drink alcohol?
That's exactly right. Yeah, it's a little microsphere that you can inject through a small needle once a month. And does just what you said. You can also use that same microsphere to, reduce people's reliance on cocaine or narcotics as well.
We've talked a lot about polymers and controlled drug delivery to things like tumors. You've also spent a good portion of your career on tissue engineering, tissue regeneration. Can you describe what that is briefly?
Sure. Well, lots of times people have serious medical problems where they don't have, their liver's gone bad or they're burned or all kinds of problems where they don't have a tissue or an organ or it's been seriously damaged. So around 1983, a friend of mine, Jay Vacanti, he's head of pediatric surgery at Mass General, he came to talk to me about this. At that time, he was head of the liver transplant program at Children's Hospital. And we started talking about ways that we might be able to use plastics and cells, mammalian cells, to craft new tissues and organs. And that would eventually lead to new strategies for creating artificial skin for burn victims, new ways of creating, livers or, intestines. A lot of them are at the research stage. We're also looking at ways of making new spinal cords for people that are paralyzed, vocal cords for people that have difficulty speaking or singing. So all kinds of things like that.
So what is the tissue made of?
Well, the strategy that we use is you have a polymer plastic scaffold, and then you put the cells on it. And over time, the cells make what's called their own extracellular matrix. So all the same proteins, hopefully, and sugars and other things that are in the human body, to begin with, the cells recreate. Hmm. And over time, that plastic scaffold dissolves. It's a dissolvable scaffold that we've designed. So in essence, rather than ladies' girdles or other things, what you're having is what the body normally would have, which are what are called these extracellular matrix proteins and polysaccharides.
So the plastic delivers, it's sort of a platter for this artificial tissue, which flirts with or fractionizes with the real tissue in the body, and they cohere and intermingle and then become their own organism.
Yeah, I think that you said it pretty well.
Hmm.
Yeah. Each tissue has its own challenges, but that's sort of the general strategy that we've developed.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Dr. Robert Langer, founder and chief researcher of the Langer Labs at MIT. Dr. Langer holds over 800 issued or pending patents. 250 companies have licensed or sublicensed the discoveries originated in his labs. Dr. Langer is a magician. I'd like to turn to your personal life.
Sure.
Tell me about this magic.
Well, I've always been fascinated by magic. So from time to time, I try to learn how to do tricks. I mean, I remember taking even a magic class and, I would always love going to magic shops and seeing people do tricks. And I used to do shows when my kids were little. And I remember one time even doing a show at MIT for 400 people. That was a while ago. I'm probably pretty rusty now.
Is there an area of magic that you prefer? Do you like the cards or the body disappearance or what?
Yeah, well, actually, I like the cards. People have often broken up magic into two kinds of magic, stage magic and close-up magic. Stage magic is like the body disappearing and things like that. But I've always liked the sort of close-up magic with cards or coins, but particularly cards. I've always thought those were fascinating.
In a way, magic and chemistry or science seem on the face of it very similar. You have something that, you know, on the surface is wow generating. And your job and your hobby is to understand how to create that wow. Your job is to understand the reasons for that outcome.
I mean, some things could even, you know, appear like magic. Like we just published a paper a week or two ago in Science where some of my postdocs found like this this plastic or polymer that can, you put it on your hand and it starts jumping all over the place. And it can even lift things. That's almost magical. And a lot of what we've ended up doing in the lab is understanding better phenomena that is extremely complicated.
How long have you been interested in magic?
Oh, I've been, you know, many, many years since I was a little boy.
You grew up in Albany, New York. What did your parents do?
Well, my dad ran a small liquor store, and my mom was a homemaker, took care of me and my sister.
What was your home life like?
It was great. I mean, you know, we lived on a small street in Albany. You know, I had a lot of friends. I remember playing baseball and football and things like that. And I went to the local public school, 27. It was nice.
You're an inventor, essentially. At what point did you think, you know, I'd like to be an inventor or some type of creator or engineer in your childhood? Were those seeds apparent to you that early?
They weren't apparent to me that early. But one of the things that I had that I got as gifts, there was a company called Gilbert when I was a little boy. And they made all kinds of great things that kids like to play with. I mean, they had this Erector set, and they had a whole bunch of different ones of various complexity, you know, where you could build structures like a merry-go-round, another where there was like a parachute jump, another where you could launch rockets. And then they also had a microscope set, and they had a chemistry set. And so I really enjoyed that kind of stuff when I was a little boy. And I even like with the chemistry set, I remember mixing different chemicals together and watching the solutions change color, which is magic. But also, it was a chemical reaction going on that caused that. But I never thought about inventing it. I just thought it was fun.
Would you say that you fell into what you're doing accidentally, or was it more mindful?
Well, I think it's somewhat accidental. I mean, you know, I certainly had no grand plan ever. I think the big thing that changed it for me in terms of what I ended up doing was what my postdoctoral work after I graduated from MIT, when I went to work for Judah Folkman. And I was like probably one of the few chemical engineers in the world, maybe the only one working in a surgery lab. And I started thinking about applying chemical engineering to medicine. And that certainly changed my life.
Dr. Folkman compared research to driving at night. Can you describe that analogy?
Yes, that's very good. Dr. Folkman said, you know, trying to solve the problem of angiogenesis or some of the other things would be kind of like driving at night. You can't see past where the headlights go, but you can do the whole trip that way. So in other words, you don't know the answer when you're starting, but you could make steps, and those steps would eventually get you there.
What are some images that come to your mind when you think of your research? You know, when is this driving at night? What about like crystallization? You know, how they have a formation of a crystal and it becomes like this whole network of crystals.
Right, right.
But that's like my own.
Sorry. Rock candy. That's significant. I mean, that's an example. I mean, certainly one thing that actually we were involved in. In fact, we started a company on that too, was a company called Transform, where one of the challenges actually when you make pharmaceuticals is having a good shelf life. Because you don't want to use a drug. If the drug after you make it is unstable after a month, nobody's going to use it. You're going to ship it all over the world. You need it, and a lot of times you won't use a drug for a year or two. So getting the drug in the right crystal form, that's in the right stability, that actually is a big deal. If you don't get it in the right crystal form, it may not be stable, and then it won't be useful to anybody.
Hmm.
But if it is in the right crystal form, it can be very stable.
You exercise daily. How long have you been exercising, and why is it so important to you?
Well, I've probably been exercising probably for a lot, probably the last 32 years, 33 years. It's important. Well, my dad died of a heart attack when he was 61, and, you know, I was 28 at the time. I mean, so I just, you know, want to live as long as I can for my kids and my wife and my family. And
what kind of what do you do for exercise?
Well, I use a recumbent bike, elliptical machine, treadmill, and weights.
For how long?
Probably 2 to 3 hours a day.
So 2 to 3 hours, that seems above average.
I think it's probably quite a bit above average, certainly for somebody my age. But I'm able to work while I do it. And my wife and kids actually exercise a lot. And, you know, we have this gym at home, so sometimes we're all doing it together, or at least a few of us. And so, it is certainly above average.
Hmm. You mentioned your wife. You met your wife at MIT. She's a neuroscientist. How did you meet?
We met on the track. I was running actually outside, and so was she. I knew her, though, a little bit because one of the people in our lab was roommates with her, so I knew her a little bit. But then I saw her on the track, and we started talking, and that's how that happened.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
It's my pleasure. I enjoyed it very much.
My guest has been the chemical engineer, Dr. Robert Langer. Coming up, we'll meet Philip Krim, co-founder of Casper. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Philip Krim, co-founder of Casper, a company focused on sleep. Casper's leading product is its mattress, which can be ordered online and delivered in a box to your door, sometimes within hours if you live in New York City. The company keeps it simple by making a one-type-fits-all mattress for consumers and believes that more choice does not mean more comfort. Casper was launched in April 2014 and had $1 million in sales in its first month. Philip is a graduate of University of Texas. Welcome.
Thank you.
I want to talk about the number of years one spends sleeping. So if you're, let's say, you have a lifespan of, let's say, 80 years, that's like 25, 26 years, right? Like
it is. It's about a third of your life. So it's an incredible amount of time. And that was something that we took very seriously when thinking about designing our mattress, was that it's one of the products that you interact with the most.
Now, you had a lot of experience with mattresses. Even before you founded Casper, you had sold about 40,000 beds. While you were a sophomore at University of Texas, you had started a company called the Merrick Group. Can you describe how you came to sell 40,000 beds? Is that right?
Over a decade that I ran that company. Mm-hmm. And really kind of fell into that category very accidentally. So with the Merrick Group, I was basically looking to avoid getting a summer job when I was in college and had the idea to build websites for products that a manufacturer would then drop ship to customers. And we sold products like window blinds, futons, tickets for sporting events, poker software, and randomly met some mattress manufacturers and sold some mattresses. And that's how I learned about this category. There's two parent companies today that own the four biggest manufacturers in this category. They work very closely with retailers to make sure that consumers don't have transparency about what they're buying. And that allows them to keep pricing high, and it allows them to keep margins high. And that forces you into a store where you're greeted by a commission salesperson who's highly trained at getting you to spend a lot more money than you have to.
So we all have had that experience of going into, let's say, Sleepy's or Bloomingdale's and, you know, laying on the mattress for 8 seconds and be like, yes, this feels right. Like, you know, it's so hard to really tell the difference between one and the next. It drives you crazy.
The reality is, and what we have said since the beginning, was that the only way to know if a bed is right for you is to sleep on it. And oftentimes it means sleeping on it for many nights so that your body can readjust to proper anatomical support. And that's why our mattresses come with a 100-night trial. And if at any point you don't love the mattress, just call us up and we'll come pick it up.
When it came time to start Casper in 2014, what led you to decide to jump into the mattress or the sleep category? I know you had that former experience, but I mean, you could have picked picked anything.
So honestly, it was one of my co-founders, Luke, asking, why is there no Warby Parker for mattresses?
So it was one of your other co-founders that coincidentally mentioned mattresses without his even knowing that you had this experience in mattresses.
Yes, and when they quickly learned about my background, you know, they just thought that was an amazing coincidence, and it led us to talking about kind of people's sleep habits and just a conversation that we kept coming back to. And we were in the same, four of the five of us were in the same co-working space, and so we were literally sitting next to each other.
So you all met kind of accidentally.
Completely serendipitously.
Where was that co-working space?
It's in New York. It was on the west side.
One of your co-founders is Neil Parikh, and
yes.
Coincidentally, too, his dad happens to be a sleep doctor.
Yes, there were a lot of amazing coincidences that came together.
Did you work out of that space together because it had brought you together?
No, we did not. We were working out of hotel lobbies. We were kind of bouncing around coffee shops. Eventually ended up in a different co-working space down in Soho. At that time, it was just us and an idea, and you know, we had no money, and it was just trying to put together the pieces that we thought we'd need to launch Casper.
And why the name Casper?
So the inspiration of Casper was actually Luke's roommate at the time. We thought it was kind of funny because Luke's roommate is like a 6'6 British guy who did not fit on his twin mattress at all.
Mm-hmm.
And we kind of all got a chuckle out of that, and we dismissed it at first. And when we got back together the next day to think more about names, and we had what felt like a million names on the list, it was the one that we just kept coming back to.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Philip Krim, co-founder of Casper, the online mattress company. Casper is focused on providing a better night's sleep for its consumers, starting with its mattresses, but extending to other products such as its pillow and sheets as well. Casper also publishes Van Winkle's, a website focused on all things sleep. I want to talk about the simplicity. Like when you just said in, among the five of you, that you were just going to make one mattress, that's it. Were you initially skeptical, or were you all kind of, yes, of course?
Honestly, we didn't go into the whole business saying we only need one mattress. It was more of, let's see what we could build, and let's see if people liked it. And it turns out when you combine the materials the way we combined it, everyone loved it. It didn't matter if you said you wanted a firm mattress or a soft mattress or a medium mattress. People loved it. And so as a result of all of this consumer testing, we said, why build another one?
How did people find out about the mattress initially? I mean, I did not see any marketing in the early days. Was it all word of mouth?
So we raised, our seed round was $1.85 million, and we raised that before we launched. We launched the bed on April 22nd of 2014, and we were fortunate to have a few people write about us and report on what we were doing, that we had raised some money and that we had built this mattress, and we had just taken a very different approach to an industry that hasn't seen innovation in a long time. Much to our disbelief, people woke up, they read these articles, and they started buying beds. And we didn't think that was going to happen. And then the second surprise was that the people that bought the bed, the people that got the bed, started talking about it on social media. They were taking pictures of it. And one of the most surprising things were how many people were filming the unboxing of the mattress. And that's something that's really unique about our experience, is that the mattress comes to life in a box that's about the size of a mini fridge.
Where were those initial articles?
It were things like TechCrunch. It was very kind of startup focused outlets. And I think, namely, they covered us because we had some funding from some great investors, and no one had really heard about kind of a mattress startup taking venture capital money.
Was this your first time taking venture capital?
It was, yes.
And what was that experience like for you?
Ben Lear of Lear Hippo Ventures led our seed round. They're one of the top seed firms in the country.
How did you meet him?
We met him. We were actually introduced to him through our branding agency. This was actually after we had been told no by dozens and dozens of investors. And so, you know, we were feeling a little dejected, and we had complete confidence that we were going to do this no matter what, even if we didn't raise a penny. And then, of course, you know, we meet Ben after we're told no so many times, and Ben just immediately got it.
Why do you think you got so many no's?
So I think there were a couple of things. One is that traditional angel and venture investors in this space always think about things in lifetime value. And how could you possibly have lifetime value if you're just selling them a mattress? And what I would come back with that is saying that the mattress industry is huge. Over $14 billion a year is spent by consumers in the U.S. at retail on mattresses. So, you know, that's a big pie we could get our small piece of. And it just didn't resonate with them because it's not how you traditionally look at e-commerce businesses. That, and then at this time, again, we weren't live. And so we didn't have our brand fully baked. We didn't have our experience fully baked. So when someone comes and tells you, oh, I'm going to build a really cool mattress brand that's going to be totally different than anything out there, you know, it's hard to wrap your mind around that. And so I get it. It does take a leap of faith, certainly, to kind of see what we see and
And then come Series B round, you raise $55 million, and included in that, in addition to the Pritzker family and institutional venture partners, are celebrity investors like Leonardo DiCaprio and Tobey Maguire and Adam Levine of Maroon 5, the band. How did these guys come in?
You know, it's funny when you tell people just how terrible the mattress buying experience is, whether you're a professional investor, an institutional investor, or just a celebrity or angel investor. Everyone kind of gets the opportunity that there's a space that's big and really important to people, sleep and sleep products, and it's really broken today. So with them, it was just, you know, introductions from other investors or from other friends, and it's great to have them on board because they get how it takes to build a brand, whether that's your personal brand or a company brand.
In addition to having this products company, you also publish or fund a media website called Van Winkle's, which is focused on everything sleep related. Why is it called Van Winkle's, by the way?
Van Winkle's goes back to the early days when we were trying to come up with a name for the business. I was championing Van Winkle's. I thought it was a great name, and it's named after Rip Van Winkle because he fell asleep for 40 years. And I ended up getting outvoted, and we ended up all liking Casper more. So Casper became the name, but Van Winkle's just always stuck with me and with the founders. And so when it came time to launch an editorial venture, we thought it was the perfect homage to the beginning days of Casper.
What was your thinking surrounding that? Just that one would fuel the other, kind of?
Honestly, the idea was that we thought sleep was such an interesting subject, and yet no one was owning or kind of furthering the conversation around sleep. Sleep is so universal. Everyone needs a night of sleep, and yet everyone has such a personal connection to it. You know, we even talk about at Casper how there were big health movements that changed the way people thought about healthy living and well-balanced living, and whether it's exercise, which happened, you know, decades ago, or healthy eating. We think sleep is kind of the next big pillar on that. 10 years ago, people were bragging about how little sleep they got, and, oh, you were an investment banker who was getting crushed at work, and you stayed and pulled an all-nighter, or a student. Now you don't hear that anymore.
I want to talk about operations in the early days. You had trouble with fulfillment in the early days because demand kind of outstrips the supply of the mattresses. Can you talk about that?
Absolutely.
I mean, what a hard problem to have, but go ahead.
It was really painful. You know, at its peak, I think customers were waiting 6 to 8 weeks for mattresses, and that was something that drove us crazy because we knew these customers, you know, were giving us good faith to try the product, and then to be so delayed was really painful. So the first day when we realized we were going to be out of stock, and we realized people were not going to have a bed when we promised them, Neil thought of, let's just send them an airbed that we could buy on Amazon and ship directly to consumers or to our customers. And so we were scrambling, pulling out our credit cards, buying airbeds for customers, shipping that, saying, you know, we really apologize. Here's a gift to you so that you have something to sleep on. And it took us many months to build up the proper amount of supply capacity. And mm-hmm. It was a huge struggle in the business, but fortunately, it's behind us, and now we're in inventory positions and ship on time within 24 hours.
Whose idea was the bike?
Honestly, we didn't even know that the box would fit in the beginning, and so we were just looking for courier partners on literally the launch day to deliver some of these beds. And so the couriers pulled up on this cargo bike, and we were just like, let's see if this fits, and it fit perfectly. It's actually become, I think, one of the more iconic images of the brand in the early days was this cargo bike with a mattress on it, and I think the bike had matching colors randomly, and it's been awesome.
You have a showroom in NoHo on Bond Street, and people can kind of just come in and try the bed out if they want to. You also have one in LA and some pop-up stores. When you thought about the business initially, was it strictly kind of an e-commerce company?
The day we launched, we had customers randomly coming by the office, knocking on the door and saying, I'd like to try the mattress. And so we quickly set up the back third of our office as a bedroom. And so anytime someone would come in, we'd happily greet them and, you know, offer them iced coffee or water and let them try the bed. And it stuck. There's no ground floor presence, so you would only find out about it if you looked on our website or our mobile site. But every day we have tons of people coming by and laying on the bed now.
I want to talk about your personal life. You grew up in Texas, in Houston. What did your parents do?
So my dad's always been an entrepreneur. He's originally a New Yorker, but he had ran his own fishing boats out of Sheepshead Bay in Brooklyn in New York. And in the late 70s, when the oil business in Texas was picking up, and specifically offshore oil in the Gulf, he had taken the fishing boats and converted them to offshore supply and crew boats that serviced rigs in the Gulf. And so that's when he moved down to Texas, and he met my mom. And again, that was late 70s, early 80s, and so he did that for most of my childhood.
You mentioned that you avoided conventional jobs. What were one or two that you had, if any?
When I was in high school, I would have a summer job at one of the local country clubs, working there.
Doing what?
Running the food cart around the course. That was one, or just, you know, at the clubhouse, kind of just a variety of jobs. One summer before college, I worked at a software company that was developing technology so that companies could monitor chats within the company for compliance issues. So lesson learned is don't talk about coworkers on chats at a company where they monitor your chats was something that
you don't do at Casper.
Don't do. Yeah.
And how about your mom?
My mom, she's currently working in Houston, but growing up, she was a stay-at-home mom. Mm.
And do you have siblings?
I do. I have a younger sister who's a nurse.
You know the term sleep tight?
Yes.
Do you know where it comes from?
I could guess, but I'm not certain, no.
People used to sleep on, or do sleep on, like ropes, right, on them for their mattress. And if you pull the rope tight, it ensures a good night's sleep.
That's interesting. I will have to read more about that one. That would not have been my guess.
What was harder for you than you thought in the early days? Because, you know, you had such great traction and acceptance from consumers. And yes, you had the hiccup with inventory, but what has been harder for you than you thought?
So one thing is hiring is definitely harder than I thought. And no one told me as a founder how much time you would just have to spend with hiring. And certainly when you're a young company, you know, no one knows how it's going to go. And, you know, again, people perceive us as this mattress company. So how could what you're doing be interesting? So hiring was certainly a struggle where we spent a lot of time. Another thing that was maybe not harder than I thought, but something that was just interesting was this founder dynamic. And so three of my co-founders had known each other for a long time. They went to school together at Brown University. And so, you know, Jeff and I were the new guys of part of the team. And in looking back, it was so important. And we just had become very good friends. And I think it's just because we spent so much time kind of thinking about the business and even outside of that, just having fun as friends. And so it's something I probably took for granted that you need to do and invest in. And it's just mm-hmm. worked out great, though.
Well, you're lucky that you were able to navigate that with, you know, five founders and not two founders.
Tremendously lucky. I mean, mm-hmm. five co-founders is very rare.
What might I not know about you?
That's a good question. Recently married.
What is your wife's name?
My wife's name's Kimberly.
And what does she do?
She just got her master's from Columbia in public health.
How did you meet her?
I met her actually on the roof of my building in the city. So one of my friends went to Syracuse University with her as an undergrad, and he was visiting us from LA, and we were both friends with him, and so he decided to combine friends so that he could see everyone while he was here, and we just hit it off there.
When did you meet her?
So it was before Casper. She saw kind of when I got excited about the idea of Casper, and tells the story fondly of me kind of waking up in the middle of the night saying, like, you know, this could be something really exciting, and then saw the five of us get together and go for it.
You know, you'd say in the middle of the night, you'd turn over and, you know, what were some of those conversations? What are some details maybe about that you might remember?
You're asking that question made me think about it. On Van Winkle's, we talk about all the time how looking at blue light is bad for your sleep. And when you look, that's why you're not supposed to look at your phone when you wake up in the middle of the night, because it's then harder to fall back to sleep. And inevitably, I always still look at my phone, and then the light comes on. And then if she sees the light, she'll say, what are you thinking about? And so that will spur random conversations at times. And to this day, I still look at my phone, even though I know that's bad for sleep and not proper sleep etiquette.
In fact, you guys should take the phone out of your room.
We should, yes. And, you know, it's funny. There was tons of, like, prescriptive sleep content out there. You should take your phone out of the room. You shouldn't look at your computer before bed. And just things that, I'm a big sleep advocate, and yet I would never do those things because it's just not going to be conducive to my lifestyle.
So how many hours of sleep did you get last night?
So unfortunately, I had a dinner work event, and so I didn't get home till later than I would have liked. So I probably got 6.5-7 hours. It's not bad, but I'm someone who needs a lot of sleep since I was a little baby. Mm-hmm. And as my wife will say, gets cranky when he doesn't get enough sleep.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
My guest has been Philip Krim, co-founder of Casper. If you would like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at fromscratchradio.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris or find us on Facebook. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch.